Montana's decision not to expand Medicaid to uninsured low-income residents has some people falling through the cracks of Obamacare. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Flathead reporter Catherine Fry looks at the growing bicycle tourism industry in Montana. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with University of Montana Vice President Mike Reed about UM's latest budget cuts and hiring chill. A ballot initiative which would expand Medicaid in Montana has run into a hang-up after the Attorney General's office noted a legal issue with the proposal. Supporters of the so-called Healthy Montana initiative are now refiling a corrected version to the Montana Secretary of State's office. This will shorten the amount of time the so-called Healthy Montana initiative has to gather signatures to be placed on the 2014 ballot. Republican lawmakers during the 2013 legislature blocked passage of Medicaid expansion, an optional piece of the Federal Affordable Care Act. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says this has created a gap in the coverage provided under that new law.
As Highway 93 runs through R. Lee, it passes by the Hanging Art Gallery.
Everything we sell, all the paintings and books and jewelry, they're all crafted by people from this area.
Donna Mollica there, she's a co-owner. It's a cafe, too, and it's actually been pretty busy today. She says because the sun's shining.
This time of the year, your customer base varies with the degree of light.
She's needing all the sunny days she can get. Back in 2009, the state split Highway 93 from a single two-lane road into two wider north and southbound roads. The southbound lanes now totally bypass her business, and she says since then, it's cut her income about in half.
If I'm lucky, I made $9,500 last year.
The 61-year-old Mollica has not had health insurance for years, but she makes just enough to where the Affordable Care Act will not help her. Executive Director of Montana Women Vote, Sarah Howell, explains it like this. If you make more than $11,400 a year, then the Affordable Care Act can give you some pretty substantial subsidies for health insurance.
Sometimes 95% subsidized on the insurance marketplace.
If you make less than $11,400, but too much to qualify for Medicaid as it stands now, like art gallery owner Donna Mollica, she falls into what Sarah Howell calls the coverage gap.
There's no option for those folks.
I'm furious that the state of Montana didn't expand Medicaid, and not especially because of my own situation.
Mollica would have been covered if Medicaid expansion would have passed. She counts herself as lucky. She's in good health right now.
There are so many people in this state that are in dire need of that assistance.
A report from the Kaiser Family Foundation says about 40,000 Montanans fall into that gap like Mollica.
It's not the state government's role to just provide health insurance to everybody.
Stevensville Republican Senator Fred Thomas, he voted against expanding Medicaid. The federal government would be paying almost the full cost of expansion for the first couple years, but Thomas worries the share the state could pay after that may eventually be a lot more as the federal government looks to shrink its budget.
And so a better approach is to go in and reform Medicaid so you make it as good a program as you can, as it currently is. Make it a great program that's delivering better for the people that are in it, and it costs less money, better health care outcomes.
He says only then should the state have any discussions on expanding the program. It's a discussion the state legislature will surely pick back up in 2015. Until then, Donna Mollica with the Hanging Art Gallery in R. Lee will continue to pay for her health care out of her already strained pocket. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, commissioners in Ravalli County voted to put the embattled county treasurer on paid administrative leave 2 days after she lashed out at criticisms that she is unable to do the work required of the treasurer. KCITV reports commissioners voted unanimously today to put Valerie Stamey on leave. She has been criticized for delays in balancing the books, depositing money, and dispersing tax money to towns, fire departments, and other entities. On Tuesday, Stamey blamed her predecessors for problems in the department, called the office a, quote, crime scene of past illegal activity, end quote, and said she planned to ask the FBI to investigate. Yesterday, County Attorney Bill Fulbright said he was ordering an independent audit of the office's accounts and financial records as well as an investigation of allegations made by Stamey on Tuesday. A Whitefish woman has denied two homicide charges filed in the stabbing death of her husband. The Flathead Beacon reports 39-year-old Anne Marie Helt Newton pleaded not guilty today to mitigated deliberate homicide and an alternative charge of negligent homicide. Helt Newton's husband, 37-year-old Chad Newton, died on December 29th, a day after he was removed from life support at the Kalispell Hospital. Newton had been hospitalized since being stabbed in the chest on November 25th. Helt Newton was initially charged with assault with a weapon and was free after posting a $25,000 bond. Deputy Flathead County Attorney Travis Honor argued that District Judge Ted Limpus should increase Helt Newton's bond to $100,000 due to the increased severity of the charges. Limpus said he would take that under advisement. Attorneys for a Colorado man charged with killing an Eastern Montana teacher are asking a judge to declare the defendant incompetent to stand trial. Today, the attorneys for 24-year-old Michael Keith Spell filed a request with District Judge Richard Simonton in Sydney to hold a competency hearing for their client in mid-March. They want the criminal proceedings against Spell suspended and for him to be institutionalized because of mental disabilities. Prosecutors say the Parachute, Colorado man strangled or asphyxiated 43-year-old Sydney High School teacher Sherry Arnold when he attempted to abduct her as she was jogging on January 7, 2012. Spell was returned to the Richland County Jail last week after a two-month competency evaluation at the Montana State Hospital in Warm Springs. Those results have not been released. The State Commissioner of Political Practices has found that two more legislative candidates illegally coordinated with corporate groups in the 2010 Montana elections. Commissioner Jonathan Modell has now issued 19 rulings finding illegal coordination by a total of five 2010 legislative candidates, including one sitting legislator. They all involve accepting illegal contributions from a secretive conservative group called Western Tradition Partnership and its affiliates. Today's rulings may say legislative candidates Joel Boniek of Livingston and Terry Bannon of Belgrade coordinated attack ads with and took unreported in-kind donations from WTP. Neither immediately returned calls for comment today. Modell says more rulings from the 2010 and 2012 campaigns are coming, as well as the first court enforcement actions. He is warning candidates against coordinating their campaigns with corporate entities in this year's elections. 16 organizations are receiving $300,000 each for research on better diagnosing and treating mild traumatic brain injuries. Two University of Montana researchers, Drs. Sarge Patel and Tom Rao, were among the 16 selected from more than 400 entries from 27 countries. The NFL and GE announced today the winners of the first stage of the $20 million Head Health Challenge. Up to six of the groups will receive an additional $500,000 next year. Patel says the ultimate goal of this project is to improve the safety of athletes, military personnel, and society overall.
The work that will come out of all of these projects, whether they go on to be the six that come on, I think we'll find out a lot about how the brain responds under these conditions and the impact of that on other diseases too. The things that we find now in this challenge could affect Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, like all kinds of neurodegenerative diseases. You know, they're all distinct, but they have a lot of common features too. And so the better you understand an underlying mechanism of one can only help in some of the other fields.
The NFL has been under pressure for its handling of concussions, with thousands of former players filing suit. We'll have more with Patel tomorrow at 5:30 on Montana Evening Edition. A contractor has begun work to fill in 50 deactivated Minuteman III missile silos in north-central Montana. The Great Falls Tribune reports the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Air Force Civil Engineering Center have chosen Bryan Construction of Colorado Springs to do the work. The initial work involves hazardous material surveys and bringing in the gravel and dirt that will be used to fill the underground silos located in Toole, Ponderay, Teton, and Shodo counties. The removal of the first launcher closure door is scheduled for late March. Once the launch facilities are eliminated, likely by early 2015, the land will be available for purchase. Adjacent landowners will have the first right to purchase the land at a fair market price. Beautiful scenery, hospitality, and beer are among the things that bicycle tourists like, and Montana has. Flathead reporter Catherine Fry has more on efforts to turn Montana into a top cyclotourist destination.
It's cycling and espresso that are really my passions.
Rennie Johnson owns Montana Adventure Sports in Big Fork.
Well, we're a multi-sport store. We have six different lines of bikes that we represent. We also have a full-service bike shop. We do vintage restoration. We do custom builds. We also sell paddle boards. We do paddleboard classes and group paddles, clothing, shoes.
Bikes and biking are a main part of the business. Along one wall, new bikes hang for sale. In the front, restored vintage bikes are on display. And in the back, a handful of stools are pulled up to a bar, kind of like around an open-air kitchen, except instead of watching a chef prep, you see a bike technician doing repairs and tune-ups. Montana Adventure Sports also has an upstairs. Johnson is in the process of turning that space into a hostel, catering to travelers by bike.
We've had so many of the cyclotourists come through Big Fork, and they say, well, where do we stay? We'll have singles, and we'll have families, we'll have couples. I mean, all types of people that just don't know where to go, and they don't want to stay in a high-priced hotel. Or the camping spot over at Wayfarers might be totally full.
Johnson says it will have a full bathroom, laundry facilities, private and shared areas. There's also a fairly new hostel on the north end of the valley, just west of Whitefish, called Whitefish Bike Retreat. Johnson says when touring bicyclists come in, he and his staff will spend a fair amount of time going over maps, directing people to back roads, unpaved roads, and helping people properly time their routes along some of the area highways. A draw for many is to bike around Flathead Lake.
And they always say, God, it's such a gorgeous lake, and I really want to ride around it. And I always tell them, well, if you're going to do it, make sure that you take Highway 35 in the morning and go south towards Polson. Then in the afternoon, come north on Highway 93 so that you can take advantage of the wide shoulder when there's more traffic.
Wider highway shoulders and better rumble strip placement are what Executive Director Jim Sayer of Adventure Cycling calls critical elements for the cyclotourist. Sayer says they've been talking with the Montana Department of Transportation to follow the lead of other states by making highways more bike-friendly while they're resurfacing or paving.
We've been hearing good things from Montana DOT because what they realize and what businesses are increasingly realizing is that bike tourism could be a real boon for Montana's tourism industry.
Adventure Cycling is a Missoula-based nonprofit that's worked over the last several decades to develop bike routes and encourage people to get out and pedal. The Tour Divide is one of those routes. It spans about 2,700 miles from British Columbia down to Mexico, running through Montana.
And it's an amazing race. It's way harder than the Tour de France. It has way more climbing. It's on dirt. And the riders have to be entirely self-supported. They have to carry their own gear, take care of themselves. They have no entourage to take care of them.
Adventure Cycling worked with the Institute for Tourism and Recreation Research out of the University of Montana on a study looking at the potential of the cyclotourism industry.
And the good news is that Montana is very desirable for bike tourists. It has fantastic scenery, as we know. It does have good hospitality, but there are things that we could do better, too.
Sayer says the elements of great biking are good trails, wide roads, and hospitality. The study surveyed 700 bike tourists who traveled in Montana between 2011 and 2013 or acquired Montana bike maps. Those surveyed had many glowing reviews about the hospitality, the views, and the unique towns. They had a less choice word for many of the roads. Terrible. Sayer says they can always keep working with businesses and communities on gearing hospitality to the bike traveler. It's getting better paths and trails that's the biggest push.
So more trails, better shoulders, better care when laying down rumble strips or rumble stripes. Those are all one big basket of things that the state can work on. And then the other is hospitality, because sometimes towns don't exactly know how to work with cyclists.
Sayer gives Twin Bridges as an example of a town that's worked out a sweet setup for bicyclists.
Well, that set up a bicyclist camp, and they offer it for free, shower and shelter. It's terrific. And then what they discovered is that the donations from the cyclists in the first year covered the entire cost of doing this, this little town of Twin Bridges, and so that the cyclists were stopping and then spending a lot of money at the local restaurant and stores.
Sayer says Montana has the potential to become a top five biking destination in the world.
When the Institute for Tourism did the study, they were asking people, what were some of the key attractions for you, and definitely scenery was number one. One of the funny things was they also found that craft breweries were a major draw.
And there's an economic incentive for such a thing. According to the UM Institute for Tourism and Economic Research, multi-day bike visitors spend an average of $75 per day while in Montana and stay an average of 8 or more nights. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
As we reported earlier this week, the University of Montana must find another $9 million to cut in the coming year, on top of the $6 million cut from this year's budget. President Roy Sankstrom outlined the need for the cuts and potential money-saving steps in a campus-wide letter this week. Enrollment began dropping at UM in the wake of a student sexual assault scandal that led to a U.S. Justice Department investigation and eventual agreement to address it. That bad publicity and changing demographics and competition for students continue to impact how many students choose to attend UM, especially those from out of state. In this feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with UM's Vice President for Administration and Finance, Mike Reed, about how the drop in out-of-state students is affecting the budget and how the university is responding.
Right. We had built the budget based on a certain number of non-resident students, kind of what we're calling the mix, the number of resident versus non-resident, upper grad, lower division, and so forth. And the one area that really didn't come as projected was the non-resident upper division students. Just this fall semester alone, that was approximately a little over $2 million in revenue we'd anticipated from that one category of students. And so that's why we're dealing with the issues in 2014. It was really that specific group. Some of the other areas were down, but that's the major area.
So you're saying $2 million down from what you expected?
Correct, in tuition revenue from the non-resident upper division students.
So that means that the budget is coming up short, and it's coming up short for fiscal year 2014, just under $6
million. Right. For 2014, when we looked at the beginning of the semester, it looked like we were going to be short, based on what we were seeing, approximately $6 million. And so we started putting things in place really at the start of the semester. Once we started seeing the mix come to play, realized that we were going to be short. And so we started putting a lot of things into place, trying to identify areas where we could reduce costs, and that's we're still looking at and working with that. But everything we look at right now looks like we should be able to, you know, make the budget so that we're balanced, and you know, we're not going to have really any substantial impact to the students and the education. We're already in the semester. We've finished this fall semester. We're into the spring semester. The courses that are scheduled are going to run. So these are really looking at salary savings in other areas to try to meet that budget deficit.
The push is coming to shove in FY 15,
correct. Yeah, and the reality is the shortfall that we're looking at in 14 kind of has a compounding effect, because the enrollment for 15 is based off of the enrollment that we receive in 14. So once we saw that the enrollment in 2014 was not going to hit the targets we anticipated, we realized that that was also going to have an impact on the 2015 enrollment as well. And so that's why you're seeing the 2015 figures come in the way they are.
And that is a decrease of $9 million.
Correct. The decrease in $9 million, and there's a lot of factors into that. Some of that is that a lot of the ways that we've been dealing with the budgets last year and this year, there have been a lot of reductions that have been made that have been one-time only. These are things that there may be some funds available, or perhaps we save some money on utilities this year. It may not be there next year, and so we can't use that as a permanent base reduction. And so we may save $1 million in one-time expenses this year. Well, that's $1 million we still have to cut next year as well. And so that $9 million includes roughly a little over $3 million in one-time only adjustments that are kind of rolling forward. So, you know, that kind of adds to the problem. It makes it easier for the year you're in, but it has a compounding effect as you roll forward.
As you were saying, the $6 million you were able to cut without there being tremendous impact or even that much impact on students. That's not going to be the case next year, is it?
Well, you know, it's one of those things. I think that there has been an impact on the students, even this year, some of the areas, some of the service areas perhaps that maybe aren't tied directly to a student's instruction. But, for example, we've made changes in our cashier's office. We haven't filled some of the positions, and we've had to make some changes there. So there may be longer lines, or there may be some of those frustrations in that way. So it has had an impact on the students, but not, hopefully not on their direct instruction. Now, rolling forward into 2015, what we're doing right now is working on a plan. What what will it look like, or what do we need to do to be able to take a $9 million base cut in the 2015 budget? Now, there's a lot of variables out here that may change. What we're looking at in this budget is hopefully a very conservative budget in 2015, but enrollment could come in stronger. Revenues could shift a lot. I mean, there's just a lot of factors in here that we're projecting. We're trying to put together an estimate right now. So I won't call it a worst-case scenario, but we're certainly saying it's a very conservative model, and then we're hoping that we can see things improve from this. But we want to plan very conservatively, because the last thing we want to do is start the year and have to make cuts in the middle of the year like we got stuck doing here in 2014.
But under that conservative budget, there is what President Engstrom is calling, in quotes, a hiring chill.
Correct. Well, we actually started the hiring chill in 2014. Basically, what we're doing is, people oftentimes hear about hiring freezes, which means we're not going to hire any new people so that we can find the budget cuts. Well, the reality is we have to hire some positions. If there are some positions that are essential and critical for the operation of the university, the hiring chill is just kind of a play on that, just really saying we're going to evaluate every position and really make sure that it is essential for the operations of the institution. So if there's a position that becomes vacant, either through somebody's moving on, they're retiring, or they're taking a position elsewhere, rather than just filling that position, we evaluate every position. We look at it and say, is this something that could be consolidated into another department? Is this a service that we really even need to continue to do? Could it be done differently? And we look at that position and we try to figure out, are there ways we could do without this position so that we don't end up needing to hire that role? And so that's what we're doing. We're looking at that with every position. And it really, really comes to play in the non-instructional areas. This is really in the support areas where the hiring chill has an impact, because those are the areas where we can really kind of consolidate and restructure. So that's what's happening there.
In the instructional area, though, there is the sort of warning in Dr. Engstrom's letter that the adjunct pool could shrink, and that full-time professors, tenured professors, are going to be picking up some classes that maybe they hadn't taught in the past.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good assessment. I mean, the reality is, unfortunately, the institution has fewer students today than we had last year or the year before. Really, since the last 3 or 4 years, the enrollment's dropped a little bit. And so we have fewer students. We have fewer sections that we need to run. And so there probably will be some compression there. And the way they're going to have to do that is really look at where the demand for the sections are, and make sure that the classes are full and just manage that. And I know that the provost and the deans and that group are, looking very seriously at how they manage that operation. But it's really a matter of structuring and resizing the institution so that we're taking care of the number of students that we have today.
There is on campus, as you know, the discussion of, is the university top heavy for administration, and shouldn't that be cut before you would start to cut, for example, class instructors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a fair, it's a fair argument. And the reality is, we need to look at both areas. Certainly, through the hiring chill, that's what we're looking at, is trying to say, look, do we restructure? Do we need to replace these positions? And how do we eliminate some of the administrative overhead and streamline operations and clean things up? We certainly need to do that, and we need to take that very seriously, and I think we are taking that seriously. Coupled with that, we need to look also just at the demand in the instructional areas and make sure that we're managing that accordingly as well. Really, in 2014, we've spent a lot of time focusing on how do we eliminate some of the support areas, support services. I shouldn't say we haven't tried to eliminate them. We've been looking at how can we offer them differently, or how can we do them in a more cost-effective manner. And so those have been the areas that we've done to try to absorb this cut that we had this year. And then we're continuing to do that as we move forward. So, I think it's fair to say both areas need to be looked at very seriously.
The university, of course, is also, at the same time this is all happening, making greater efforts to recruit students.
Right.
And that will be an ongoing thing, and you hope to turn the tide. But I think the caveat there is that tide is not going to turn in a matter of months. It could be years.
Well, it could, and that's part of the challenge is we're seeing some positive signs just on the investments and the strategies have been put in place this past year, and we're starting to see some indications that our enrollment might be stabilizing, and we're really anticipating to see what's going to happen this coming fall, just to see where that brings us into. But over the last few years, we've had a little smaller incoming freshman class, but we've been graduating larger classes. And so even if we were to start getting a larger incoming class this next fall, we're still probably going to see a decline in total enrollment over the next year or two, simply because we have larger classes that have to go through that pipeline. It's a 4 or 5 year process for that to happen. So we've seen the smaller class for the last 2 years. We probably have this year and possibly next year to go before we really see a turnaround in the overall enrollment. We should start seeing a little larger incoming freshman class, hopefully, within the next year or two.
And, of course, if people want to know more about this budget process, there's several meetings coming up, and those are all posted on the university website. If people want to participate in those meetings or just witness the discussion, they're certainly free to do that.
Absolutely. We try to release all of this information to the University Budget Committee and try to go over it in great detail. We show the data and put it up there and answer questions, and people are welcome. It's an open meeting, and we have those posted out on the website, and we also have the minutes and any of the slides, and that information will also be shared on that website as well.
Well, I have been speaking with University Vice President Mike Reed talking about the current budget situation at the University of Montana. Mike, appreciate your time. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with some patchy freezing fog and lows in the teens. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies, some patchy freezing fog in the morning, and highs should be in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana tonight, look for partly cloudy skies with lows 25 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with highs in the 40s. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly clear with lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with highs 35 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Kit Fisher.
And again, almost like clockwork, the Yellowstone Bison Wars begin. This time, however, it's a much different and important battle. As deep snows continue to accumulate on the high Yellowstone Plateau, and bison begin their historic and highly anticipated migration out of the park, Montana's Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and the Board of Livestock are once again at odds over where America's largest wild bison herd should be allowed to roam. Usually expanding bison habitat is fraught with controversy, and rightly so. It is well known that some of Yellowstone's bison, as well as its burgeoning elk populations, carry brucellosis, a veritable kryptonite to the livestock industry, a disease that, ironically enough, cattle initially introduced and has become a buzzword that has plagued bison expansion efforts for decades. The most contentious solution supported by livestock interests is vaccinating wildlife. One such program recently nixed by the Park Service included the use of bio-bullets in an attempt to reduce the prevalence of brucellosis. Luckily, wildlife managers understand that spending countless resources on a remote vaccination program will not solve the disease issues that have haunted Yellowstone's wildlife for nearly a century. Eradication of brucellosis would require every single elk and bison to be vaccinated in a region the size of Connecticut, a seemingly impossible feat. A better option, and the option currently in front of the Board of Livestock and FWP, is not to confine the movements of bison, but to expand year-round tolerance outside of the park. This would include places like the Taylor Fork, Horse Butte, and the Upper Gardner Basin, an immense 400,000-acre buffer of 98% public national forest lands that could provide critical wintering habitat and minimal conflict with livestock. Thankfully, over the past 10 years, an incredible amount of work has happened to get us to the point where we're at today. The National Wildlife Federation and other conservation leaders have been working collaboratively with livestock producers to create a landscape adjacent to Yellowstone Park that can accommodate a wild bison population. We've done this via voluntary grazing retirements, an approach that has won strong public support as a proactive, free market method to solving wildlife-livestock conflicts. Our first key retirement for bison was the Horse Butte allotment, which removed a significant conflict on the west side of the park. We then retired the Cache Elridge and Wapiti allotments in the Gallatin River drainage, which opens up a substantial area for bison. Then we retired the Slip and Slide allotment north of the park by Gardner. But what may be our most important grazing agreement took place on private land. Working in partnership with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, NWF negotiated an agreement with the Church Universal and Triumphant to cease cattle grazing on the Royal Teton Ranch. This has been a bottleneck for bison movement north of the park. These retirements have led to the current situation, where the risk of contact between bison and livestock is very low. And we know that the potential for disease transmission between bison and cattle is extremely low if separation is maintained during birthing periods. So why is expanding habitat something Montana's livestock industry should welcome? By confining bison within the borders of the park, managing the species population and movements are extremely difficult. And as history has shown, it's only a matter of time before the next bad winter sends bison into troubling territory, resulting in the untenable situation of hazing, capturing, and slaughtering wildlife. By allowing bison to occupy sizable habitat outside the park year-round, it will give Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, interested tribes, and Montana sportsmen the opportunity to manage the bison to a population that is suitable to livestock interests. This is Kit Fisher with the National Wildlife Federation. Thanks for listening.
Kit Fisher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition, and the views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening.